Well, we're going to get started. Welcome to the fourth annual Philadelphia Podcast Festival recording of Story Shuffle. It is a once every other month storytelling event among friends. I'm Chris Wink. I'm the co-founder of, co-creator of Story Shuffle. But for about 5 years, 6 years, we've been recording among friends every other month, and we're really proud to always be a part of the Philadelphia Podcast Festival this year in 2016, the fourth annual Philadelphia Podcast Festival happening here at Amalgam Comics, the fantastic comic and coffee shop on 2578 Frankfurt Avenue in beautiful Kensington, Philadelphia. We're also being live recorded by SteelEmpire.com, great audio recording company, Steel, S-T-E-E-L-E, Empire.com. You should check them out. We love Steel. Thank you, Steel, for recording us. Steel Empire is wonderful. Amalgam's wonderful. So is Nathan Karuna and his team that organizes the Philadelphia Podcast Festival every year. But this recording, this Story Shuffle, we have four friends. I count as one of them, whether or not that the other three count me as a friend. We are our four friends.
We're gonna talk about that.
Yeah, we will talk about that. Four friends. We're given a topic. We will tell a personal, a first-person, personal nonfiction story. We'll hear it. We'll learn. We'll have fun. Yeah, don't make up stories, and we'll go from there. So that's the show. If you want to check out other Story Shuffles, StoryShuffle.com has like 6 years of recordings about lots of topics. Super fun. And so thanks for being a part of it. So we got four friends here that will be telling stories. Yuri Pierre Noel is a wonderful art curator, art seller. We have L. Sawyer, a wonderful documentarian. And we have Archana Sahai, the City of Philadelphia's Commerce Department, also an artist, I'm sure, in her own right in so many ways. She has a fantastic superhero shirt on. So this counts for something, and a fashionable artistic nature. So we got four stories. Our theme this month is bubble, which can be taken so many different ways, as it should be. And I'm going to turn to my dear friend Yuri Pierre Noel for our initial story with the theme of bubble. Yuri Pierre Noel, tell us a story about bubbles.
Okay, bubbles. Well, Chris, at first, I do count you as a friend. I answer your emails and also your text messages. So that's a friend.
Counts. It's true. And few don't.
So for me, I'm a first-generation Haitian, meaning my parents emigrated from Haiti, obviously. And when they originally came here in 1980, they arrived in Brooklyn. My mom came before my dad, and she actually came with her two brothers and her sister. My grandmother at the time in Haiti was actually an entrepreneur. She started a dressmaking business and had ran it successfully for about 5 years after her husband had died, and he was an architect. So my grandmother was sort of the very strong, no-nonsense Haitian woman. I'm not sure if you've had any experience with Caribbean grandparents. They have very little patience and a lot of opinions.
Are there any pro-nonsense Haitian grandparents?
That would be the third generation. That usually takes a couple years to work into, like the, oh, listen to what you have to say, son. That doesn't happen in the first generation. It's pretty much authoritarian. But so they came to Brooklyn, which was a mixing pot at the time. At that time, Brooklyn was really packed with a lot of Haitians who had left the country due to a lot of issues with the politics in the country. My dad, who actually came about 2 years after my mom, he was a writer originally in Haiti. He wanted to write. He loved it. And then he had his life threatened. And then he quickly was like, no, I'm good. I don't even know how to write. And just became a social worker. And then that became a political issue because of the social issues that he was facing and how he wanted to go about solving them. The administration at the time pretty much told him, leave the country. You have 50 days. Mm. And he left in 10. So he got out. He did not waste time. So that was 1980. In Brooklyn, my sister was born first. She's how can I put this? She's more of the perfect Haitian child than I am. She's very, very, very obedient and very, very nice. I grew up a little bit harder than that. So our parents, after they had my sister and I. My dad made the decision as a teacher in New York to move us to upstate New York in Kingston. I'm not sure if anyone has ever lived in upstate New York in any capacity. If you have, you understand just how desolate that part of the country is. It's like going to Maine, where there's like three people. It was a huge culture shock going from like Brooklyn, where we had like reggae music at 3 a.m. You had like beef patties at like 2, and like you had everything you could ever want. That's what I thought when I was a kid. But moving to Kingston, you heard crickets. I remember actually being scared of the sound of crickets outside the window. I was wondering, I was like, what is that sound? Mom, what is that? She's like, it's nature. Don't be afraid.
It's nature.
Go to it, you know. So that was a huge, huge shock. But we went back and forth between Kingston and Brooklyn, because my dad always lived in Brooklyn, and he has a strong love for the city of New York, and he just refuses to leave. I think it's like pretty much where he found most of his friends, or I don't know. But so going back and forth between Kingston, New York, and Brooklyn was sort of like, dare I say, jumping in and out of a bubble, frankly, because mm-hmm. in Kingston, we were like the one black family out of like 10,000 people, which was fine because everyone knew who we were, because you could not know who we were. It's like, oh, you're the Pierre Noels. How's your dad? You know, like, he's fine, yeah. And then going back to Brooklyn was a huge culture shock every once in a while. And just watching how our neighborhood progressed, we grew up in a very strong Dominican and Haitian neighborhood, and had a lot of culture and Caribbean vibes in the neighborhood. And over the years, going back and forth and back and forth, it became this sort of like weird, like transplant New Yorker kind of atmosphere. You know, like the neighborhood store went from selling American cheese to provolone, which was like a huge jump for a lot of people. And it was just a huge shock to see what happened to a lot of my friends as they began to sort of get pushed out of where we grew up.
Where was that? What neighborhood were you in?
Eastern Park. We moved a lot. So it was Eastern Parkway, Flatbush, Newkirk, Nostrand. If anyone knows Brooklyn here, they know what I'm talking about. I'm looking right at you. So that was sort of growing up back and forth between those two cities. But even more so, it wasn't even about where we lived. It was how our parents raised us. They're very strict when it came to speaking Creole. So I'm fluent for the fact that my parents wouldn't let us eat food if we couldn't say the food in Creole and ask for everything in Creole. So if you wanted like cereal, like, hey, mom, can I have some cereal? I do not know what you're talking about. What is that? Like, you know, like, she was very serious. And then, like, in front of my friends, she did not care. She has, to this day, zero tolerance policy. If I'm in the house, if I see her, I have to greet her in Creole, and then I'm allowed to maybe throw in some English if she's like, all right, fine.
So how do you greet somebody in Creole?
Well, first, your mom. Bonjour, mommy. Mommy, it's always mommy, you know, or papi. Like, I didn't know my parents' first names until, like, I came across some documents as a kid, and I was like, what? My name is Joannem? That's so weird. My dad's name is Joannem. My mom's name is Marie. Her actual full Haitian name was, like, Marie-Rode Pianoel, and I actually never knew it. I think I was, like, 10 mm-hmm. when I figured it out. But until then, she was just mommy. Like, mommy, can I have this?
Was there a food that you remember as a kid, like, always having to remember how to say it in Creole?
Yes. Legume is, like, it's like every vegetable you can think of boiled down to like its cellular level, and then it's like throw some sauce, throw some cashews in there, boom, legume. You can eat it any time of the year, and apparently it's supposed to make you very strong, because my mom told me. I don't know if it really helped. I hated it. I hated it a lot. In fact, I used to just sit at the table and just look at it and hope that she would get tired of watching me, because she really wouldn't let you leave the table until you finish eating.
So you'd have to say it in Creole.
Yep.
And you couldn't leave the table until you eat it.
Yeah.
But you didn't like it anyway.
No. Wow, they're very, very serious about it.
I feel like our parents know each other. Yeah. I feel like they may have
something. They might.
They might. Sounds a lot like how I grew up.
Yeah, it was interesting. But it helped me so much because I learned how to have an appreciation for Haitian culture. But the funny thing about having a strong appreciation for Haitian culture is Haitian natives, there's a term called diaspora. Jaspola refers to someone who is not born in Haiti, but then returns to Haiti and sort of like tries to acclimate themselves, like, hey, I'm Haitian too. And they're like, you're Jaspola. It's sort of like saying, like, you're not really one of us, but you're like, cool, you can hang out with us. And that was interesting because our parents always told us we're Haitian in the house. Mm-hmm. Outside, we're American. Mm. So when I came home with anything, like, say if I were like, I'll admit it, I sagged my pants when I was a kid. I tried it. It was like a week, 1 week. I tried this.
It was definitely more than a week.
No, my mom bought me five belts afterwards and then like threw out the pants that I wore.
Right.
My mom it was serious. But yeah, so they're very, like, and it's funny because a lot of Haitians, and I dare I say Caribbeans, identify first with their nation before they identify as being called black. And it's so serious that I've seen it on government forms where they say Haitian, oh wait, no, black, and then next to it, including Haitian. I kid you not, you can look this up. There was like this whole controversy about that because Haitians would see the word black and be like, what's that? I'm Haitian. What's that? They would choose other and then write Haitian, and people are like, no, we classify you as what? I'm Haitian. Like, you could not tell a Haitian mother that she was black. It does not work out well in your favor. But yeah, so that was definitely fun. I mean, aside from the cultural differences and aside from going back and forth, I do have to say, moving forward, I've seen a lot in terms of how Haitian culture today is being embraced in a way that, growing up as first generation, though I was always so proud of it, I never knew that there was a negative opinion of Haitians. I never knew those stigmas, right? Like, for example, the term anchor baby. I never heard that. I found that in like a textbook like years later. I was like, what is this? You know, apparently in Brooklyn there was an issue with several people. Well, it was an issue in general in the borough where a lot of first-generation kids were being called that in reference to their parents being immigrants and saying, oh, your parents are allowed to stay here because you were born here.
Wow.
You know, it's sort of like you get pregnant in Haiti, but you have a child in America kind of thing. So it became a really weird issue when I sort of looked into it. But now when I go back to New York, I mean, it's like Haitian flags everywhere. There's like Haitian festivals. And it's just... it's such a vibrant scene from what I used to see. And the issues are more contemporary than they used to. I mean, my dad, he's like 50 plus now, and he still talks about the 1980s in terms of politics. And I'm like, those guys are dead. Like, why are you? He's like, man, and Papa Doc was in, no, it was horrible. Like, dad, I was like 20, 30 years, like, leave it alone. But yeah, so it's really changed. And I can say I never felt uncomfortable as being a first generation Haitian, but it sort of excites me and gives me a little more, you know, hope for my kids, you know, bringing them into that culture and, you know, but also not creating the bubble my parents did where you're only Haitian in the house and American outside. But
so you let them eat food?
Yes, they don't have to speak Creole. But that's Creole is so much fun, though. We have a phrase called M'apprasionti Creole. It means I'm going to break into some Creole. It's like, imagine if you were like, oh, I'm going to break into some English. Like, is this going to be fun? Like, M'apprasionti Creole is like, you get comfortable just like speaking the language of Lakai, and Lakai means home, so you just revel in it and just like hang out.
That's cool.
And it's a way to hang out and enjoy yourself. But yeah, so that was growing up Haitian in Brooklyn and the Hudson Valley. I guess the last thing to end is, I'll have to say, when I moved more recently to Boston, in Philadelphia, where I lived, there wasn't a big Haitian community. But I will say, when I moved to Boston, man, it's everywhere, and I love it. I was on the train. Cool. One last story. This is a crazy thing. I was shopping for bread. This grandmother walks up to me, and she says, "Petit, achem ça, s'il vous plaît. Come up, you know, can you buy this for me, please?" I'm like, whoa, hold on. First of all, I didn't say anything in Creole. How do you know I'm Haitian? Her first words are, of course you're Haitian. That's it. So, I mean, I don't know if I got that face or something, but it...
Cool. I get that a lot too.
But yeah, that was a wake up. I've never had that happen before. So yeah. And that's just growing up Haitian.
Can we thank Yuri for talking to us about breaking the bubble of Haitian in America, being a Haitian in America? El Sawyer, documentarian El Sawyer, I hear you also have a story about bubbles in some form.
Yeah.
El, you want to tell us about it?
Yeah. Not quite the first generation Haitian over here, but
you're like a second generation Haitian.
Second or third, something like that. But you are my friend.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad we're fact checking
that.
Right.
Each we're
one by one. I'm very
that.
Worried about Arson is going to be the third.
Yeah,
I'm very worried.
However, I don't really return emails or I'm the worst with that.
True.
So
big stress confirming
break that
the speaker shot
type
right
of
here.
A friend returns emails. So yeah. Bubbles. Where do I start? So basically, when I read that, and I'm just thinking about the concept of bubbles, I know it's kind of ambiguous or whatever, but I think it kind of is in line with a lot of the work I do anyways, right? A lot of my work is around kind of, I'm a filmmaker by trade, And a lot of my work is around kind of using the medium of film to actually inform people or give somebody this kind of ability to see a, see someone else's life or experience someone else's experience without it actually being their personal experience, or kind of, you know, almost kind of bringing it to them, kind of creating a package, I guess, for them to observe and to actually kind of build some kind of empathy for another human being and conditions. So basically, let me just start with saying the tie-in for me, almost, not say literal, but there was a gentleman who was my old head, very dear guy, man. He's from North Philly. His name is Big Man, so James Big Man Maxton, right? And James Big Man Maxton was a big guy. As the years go on, he kind of gets a little bit bigger. He starts out like six, all kinds of ways. So he starts out at like 6'5", which he probably was around 6'7" or whatever. But and he's gotten up to like 7 feet tall at this point. But Big Man was a director of an organization called the Village of Arts and Humanities in North Philly. And the Village of Arts and Humanities is an organization that is very dear to my heart. I'm a director still there at this organization. And I've been there better part of 14 years. The organization is about 30-year-old. It's about a 30-year-old organization. And Big Man was there basically from the beginning. He talks always about how art was a kind of transformative tool for him in his life. You know, he started at the Village, or went to the Village. You know, he was into drugs and, you know, doing this whole thing, living his life, right? He heard the founder of the organization is Lily A. And Lily A is, you know, Chinese-born American. She's about 4'1" or something. And just this big ball of
big
light.
Man gets bigger and Lily gets smaller, as the story
There's
goes,
the
yeah.
dynamic. You're starting to notice bubbles, right?
That's right.
She's this big ball of just angelness, right? Like, and she still is, right? So she started, you know, founded this organization and basically was hiring people in the neighborhood to actually do kind of like land transformative kind of art placemaking in North Philly. When she got Big Man, again, like I say, he got a word that, oh, this Chinese lady's in the neighborhood and she's paying people to do work. We're about to get rich, right? We hit it. We did it. But when he showed up, and he was a mason by trade, and when he showed up and he actually was doing little masonry work here and there, he observed her doing this kind of art sculpture of a mosaic kind of tiling, very similar to Isaiah Zagar. And actually, Isaiah Zagar actually assisted in a lot of the training and stuff at the Village. It's the 2500 block of Germantown Avenue. And when Big Man was doing masonry work, and if you know anything about mosaic work and masonry work, it's actually the same thing. But Big Man, in his bubble, had never been exposed to art that way. Big Man, early on, was a football player, a huge guy, being as big as he is, from North Carolina, from Smithfield, North Carolina. And he came up north with his family, and in his first year he blew his knee out and literally went kind of downhill from there. Once he couldn't play football, that was like a main thing in his life. He quit school, immediately went to drugs, and it just spiraled downhill. So basically, he lived on 11th Street, 11th and Huntington, and, you know, he basically, you know, went through his life that way. So when he met Lily, Lily is building these pillars of mosaic tiles that were her representation of trees in this art park. And as soon as he's seen that, he was, you know, interested because, wow, that's beautiful and that's exactly what I do. So, you know, whatever. So he didn't ask Lily how to teach him or anything. He basically waited till everybody left and stayed afterwards and, and did it. And then, you know, he went on to actually... mosaic a lot of parks in North Philly, and he actually did a big piece for the World's Fair. Big Man always spoke about, like, you know, art was that transformative tool, but he spoke very vividly about this theory that He said, "The hood grows walls." Mm. That was his thing. The hood grows walls. Now, when I met Big Man, I was 25 years old. I myself, just came home from prison. I did 8 years in prison from the age of 17 to 25. Mm. When I came home, basically, I had a certain perception about what I was going to do and be. And I thought I understood kind of life in the sense that, I had been to some of the pits of our society in the worst way. So I felt like, I kind of understood that. But I wasn't, at 25, I didn't know that I only understood it from this, kind of very, isolated bubble kind of perspective. Mm-hmm. It was so insular and in a vacuum that way. When I met Big Man, being, his demeanor, he's, from North Philly, he throws you off to make you think that I'm not going to really learn a whole lot from this guy. In my brain, I was like, all right, whatever. Big Man was amazing, right? So he actually, when he told me the hood grows walls, and he used to give speeches all the time and talks when people at the village, when people will come there, and I used to sit and listen to him. And later on in life, that theory kind of just makes all the sense in the history to me, right? To the point where now my work, I have a film company. It's called Media Neighborhoods Group, and we do films, right? And a lot of our films are contracted or funded in part by the Department of Justice. So at no point did someone who did 8 years in prison and 2 years in juvenile before that sold drugs my whole life since I was 12 and was into that world. No high school education, none of that, no college, just nothing. To be contracted to do film work for the Department of Justice and to be thriving in that and actually traveling around the country and now the world doing that. When his theory, Hood Grows Walls, just ties right into that, because for me it's like this film work I do is like we're showing, for instance, judges that actually, hire people, or excuse me, that sentence people. We have, police officers, or probation and parole, or whatever the deal is, wardens, and we can actually show them the environment in which these people are coming home to, some of the conditioning and some of the kind of isolated, almost like toxic, not almost, but totally toxic environments that these individuals have to actually be raised in and actually foster and actually it's on them to actually try to create a hope and future for themselves and how impossible that can be sometimes. Big Man saying, the hood grows walls is like almost like the anthem to everything we do now. Mm. It's like trying to convince people and show people what those walls are and how they're created and trying to tear those walls or those bubble walls made out of bubble wrap. No, I'm playing. Those bubbles or those walls, tearing them down.
There was not a quota that you had to say bubble 15 times.
Okay, right. Bubble. But that's my story. And I stand by it. No, I'm playing.
I really like that hood grows walls. So, what is different? Like, what about the documentary work you're doing is fighting those walls or breaking those walls?
Right. Well, first of all, I am a filmmaker, and the fact is, like, I'm making films from the inside. Me and my crew, right? We have amazing teammates. John Kaufman and a couple of other amazing people. Liddy Vez is here. So we do a lot of stuff that way. So basically, what it is it's an authentic stance, right? It comes from like as an insider perspective that lets people know, from an inside, like exactly kind of what those environments are. And you'll be surprised. I mean, the idea is that we've learned, and again, when we made the film originally, or any of the work we do originally, did not come from an academic perspective at all. I mean, Chris, you know me, right? Seriously. I know Chris a long time. And Chris, you know me that I do nothing academically.
In the most positive sense, though.
Yeah, or Whatever. Whatever. No, no. No, academics is cool. For some.
That's
no, but
the hashtag for today's
there you go.
Podcast.
So, I mean, you know, so what do we do different? So the idea is that we're, you know, we kind of use this kind of personal kind of, this personal kind of first person kind of experience to actually kind of walk someone through it. Because the idea, it's not about indicting anyone. It's not about right or wrong at all, right? Yeah. It's about how do we move forward appropriately and how do we actually get to know someone as a human? Like you're speaking about first generation, being a first generation Haitian and those nuances, the fact that you mentioned provolone, right? So, I mean, to me, as a filmmaker, I'm vividly seeing this whole situation and trying to make sense out of it. But that one little nuance, I couldn't have known that.
Yeah, provolone is weird. It tastes good, but it's weird.
It is. I just ate some a few minutes ago, and it is weird in a good way. But, no, I'm just saying, you know, so what's different about it, I guess, is our approach. This weird kind of position that we've been fortunate enough to kind of carve out and actually getting adopted, you know, into this kind of sect of our society, being the government, to be able to be trusted enough for them to, like, know that we're not trying to indict them, but we're trying to actually insist that they understand and insist that they move appropriately so.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Can we thank El Sawyer for talking about breaking a bubble in his own way?
Yes.
Can we give him a round of applause? Where does Swiss cheese lie on that? It's like American provolone.
I feel
Swiss
like I'm not getting the value for my dollar because there's like holes in this thing. I'm just like, what's going on?
I
think Gruyere is probably the worst cheese there is. Gruyere cheese? Okay. Hate it. It's horrible.
Yeah. And now it's a cheese podcast.
Yeah.
Well, our third storyteller, Ms. Arshna Sahai, you also have a story about bubbles. How coincidental and convenient for today's setting.
Yeah, I feel like it's magical.
Arshna, can you please tell us
your
story about bubbles?
So, I mean, I figure we should just start off. Chris and I are friends.
Yes. Three for three. Nailed it.
You do not have to pay me to come here today. I'm absolutely here on a personal capacity, not official. So everything I say is off the record.
Off the record as we live record the internet.
And I usually wait until I get the texts that are like in all caps before I respond to Chris. I'm like, ignore. And then I get the all caps one. Okay,
Everyone knows that, yeah.
So, again, so I'm thinking about bubbles, and I'm like, all right, what can we talk about? And I think, you know, we ourselves put ourselves into, like, definitions and build walls around us and say this is who we are, define ourselves a certain way. But society tends to do that to us too. So growing up, I am an immigrant as well. I came here when I was 5 from India. Chubby little kid, funny name, right? Really bad dresser, smelled like curry like the entire time, right? Because that was house, that was home. I didn't know any different. Like that was my like bubble inside the house, right? And my parents had an arranged marriage, and they grew up in like 1950s Bihar, and Bihar is a very conservative part of a very conservative country in India. And so having those two bubbles of growing up in American society outside the house and then coming home and speaking Hindi, all like my dad was militant, right? Like the first song I learned, like music was a big part of my life growing up, was the national anthem for India. Yes. Like I had to stand up and sing it as I was like playing the song. Like this was my world, right? And yet I leave and I'm like saying national flag. I can't even remember it anymore. Like when you get in front of the flag and you say,
are you asking me for the Indian national anthem?
Is that no. Elementary school when you get up and you
Pledge
say
of
the
allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance. Yes. See, I'm bad American. Okay. So, I mean, these were my two worlds that I was trying to, like, balance out. But anyway, so, like, when I first started school, they put me in ESL because they're like, oh, she's an immigrant. She can't possibly speak English, right? And I'm like, I learned it, like, way before you guys did, right? Like, I went to school earlier, learned it at the same time. Like, let's be honest, guys.
Thanks, Brits.
Seriously, that was one good thing they did for us. So, anyway, so within, like, 3 months, I'm out of ESL. But, I mean, just growing up, you have, like, people's perceptions of you. And it's hard not to absorb some of those things. So, you know, I mean, at some point I started kind of breaking all that stuff down. Didn't become a doctor.
That was
a big one. That was a big one. Didn't become an engineer. That was a big one. Went into finance, which was, like, really bad. And then, you know, not going to go back to India and get married. Ooh, that was a tough conversation. Not going to have an arranged marriage. That was a tough conversation. And then all of a sudden, I found myself at 28, absolutely broke, no job, Probably really bad credit score at that point, too. All of my stuff in the back of a rental. Driving home from the Midwest. Driving back to my parents' home from the Midwest. Fighting to leave an abusive relationship with an Indian guy, South Asian guy. So here I am thinking I'm doing all these right things, getting married at the right time, getting engaged at the right time. We never got married. Broke off the engagement, came back home, and it was one of the most terrifying moments of my life, but at the same time, extremely liberating, because it was like I was a South Asian, I was a woman, I was an immigrant, I was expected to do all these kinds of things, but none of those things were really things that I had set up for myself. It was just me living in a bubble that other people had created for me, or living expectations that other people had created for me. And so in this one very, very supremely scary and liberating act, I found that I had created a world of my own. And oh my God, the sun still came up the next day. My parents were in the kitchen making breakfast. My friends were still calling me. They were still picking up my phone calls. The world was fine. And just like that, all of a sudden I was like, oh, I can kind of define these things for myself and I can create a world for myself. And I mean, they say, you know, that you shouldn't only carry the past with you to the extent that you learn from it. And that's probably one of the few stories in my life that I continue to carry with me. Not because, like, people say, they're like, oh my God, are you over it? Like, you're not over it, you're still talking about it. I'm like, well, the thing is there's a lot to learn from it, right? I don't want to be defined by that. I want to be defined by the things that happened after that particular point, right? Like moving to Philadelphia, meeting wonderful people, and like recognizing that all the experiences and the things that I've done post that point would never have happened had I not said, this little bubble that I'm in right now is no longer working for me, and I have to break out of this and do something different for myself. So that was, you know, what. And even like in driving back, like I remember, I'm like in the car, I'm driving, and it was 22 hours it took me to get back to my parents' house. And I'm in Columbus, it's in Ohio, and I've probably been driving for 12 hours straight at this point. I'm in the right lane, the car totally veers off because I fall asleep. Right? I fall asleep. And it veers off, and there's grass on the ditch. There was no reason for my eyes to have like opened up. There was no reason that I should have like woken up at that point, but I did. And I got back on the road, and I stayed up the entire time and made it home. And it's just like, you know, you look back on those things and you reflect on that stuff. And I'm Hindu, and spirituality is a big, big part of our culture, our religion. And again, it's just one of those, like, I feel validators and reminders that, like, you are supposed to be here, and what you're doing is fine and right, and you need to get out there and, you know, create that new world. So that was kind of like my thought process when I was thinking about bubbles. I'm like, we build these walls around us, but it's more about like breaking those walls down and defining that world that you live in, like for yourself and by yourself. And Philadelphia has definitely played a very, very big role in that. I've been trying to get out of Philly since I got here in 2002. I'm like, oh God, I don't like this place. But in 2013, I moved back and I committed. I'm like, I'm here, I'm doing this. And I would say this bubble I am very, very happy with. Like, I enjoy this bubble very, very much.
We welcome. Thank you, Arshna, for that story. What a part of your immigrant bubble do you still maintain? I feel like there has to be some portion that you like maintaining.
Oh, of course. I love being South Asian. Indian. Well, honestly, like, you know, my parents are still trying to get me married off. Like, let's not like kid about that. Until I turned 35, they were still like, oh, you can still go back to med school. Like, you can go to med school. You can still do this. And I'm like, no, I can't. No. No. You can still do it.
Yeah, like, our parents know each other.
Yeah.
They definitely do.
Right?
Yes.
And, like, and in the house. But, like, in breaking out in Haitian, like, it is. It is really nice to, like, have these two completely different worlds that you work every day to kind of like bring together and figure out how to make it all fit. So, I mean, Bollywood, love me some Bollywood, who doesn't like that? Indian food, love it. And also just speaking Hindi at home and like having, you know, family halfway across the country that I can lean on and go to should, you know, Trump become president of the United States. I am out of here, guys. Like, let's be honest. But no, I maintain all of it. It was more just realizing that the cultures are very, very different, and the expectations that are laid upon women in particular, but then also immigrants and South Asians here in the United States, it's tough. And finding your way through that and figuring out how to merge those two worlds together is really difficult, but there's a lot of joy and a lot of fun in that too. And you bring your parents along in that journey, right? They've come a long way. I mean, they're fabulously hilarious. Now they're fabulously hilarious. Before they were annoying. But.
What's something in Hindi you say most often to your parents? And what would their response be?
Well, I say no in Hindi a lot. I say nahi. Like nahi. Ye nahi karna hai, wo nahi karna hai. They just shake their head. They're like, whatever. I mean, my dad doesn't say it. Well, he'll say it. My mom will probably say it. She'll be like, tumhari shaadi nahi hogi kyunki tum bahut baat karti ho. So basically, she's saying, you talk too much, which is why you'll never get married. And I'm like, thanks. Wow. Like, I am surprised there's not a reality show on Indian parents yet. Like Kardashians, give me a break. You guys need to find a South Asian family with daughters that are not married, and you will have some hilarious television.
Oh, that's
but yeah, she says that to me all the time. Dad says that to me, too. He's like,
that's lovely.
That's my bubble.
That is a lovely story of bubble breaking. Hey, guys, I have one, too.
What? Did we, like, send an email out about this or something? Like I feel like we coordinated really well
here. Preparation, indeed. Yes, I have a story of bubbles as well. So, misremembering is different than forgetting. And that's something that I remember learning deeply the summer after I graduated high school, when I was working for a general contractor. It was the first in an array of construction jobs I worked. I worked for a plumber and a carpenter later, but I started with a general contractor because it required the least skill, and I was very unskilled, so it worked out really nicely. My boss, which is a very bushy bearded guy, I never knew what emotion he was wearing because he was hidden behind a like salt and pepper giant biker beard. He was a bicyclist. He would always tell me that you're cheaper and dumber than every Mexican I ever hired. That was what he would pretty commonly say to me. It was a colorful summer for sure working for Diamond Construction. I think he approved of me, but it came out in all kinds of interesting ways. I remember the first work site that I showed up on to work with him. This was in North Jersey. It was an historic Victorian home, and we were putting tin roof shingles. Kind of like an 1880s kind of ritzy thing that this family was restoring its home with. The third thing he said to me was, "You can pee in the bushes. Don't go inside the house." He was like, "There's no way that I'm gonna let you in and see this family." Generally treated me as a disgrace, which was probably not far off for the 18-year-old version of myself. But the first task
how
I had.
How old were you when
I
met
you? I was 18.
When I met you?
Oh, yeah, we met about 10 years ago. It was probably 2022, so a couple years after this, two or three years. I was way more polished.
Polished is the right word.
I still remain polished. So the first ask he gave to me, like you do when an 18-year-old shows up, but he's like, "All right, go get coffee for the work site." I remember him saying, he's like, "Write everything down." I got a piece of cardboard, I got a carpenter's pencil, and I started taking people's orders. And when he overheard me ask someone, "Does cream mean milk?" Because I was 18 and had never drank coffee before, I was kind of perplexed by what everything meant. So I was like, "Does cream mean milk?" He like shook his head, climbed down on the ladder, and he said, "I'm going to go with you once, and I will never go with you again. And if you screw anything up, you're out of here." So he takes me to a Dunkin' Donuts nearby, and he's ordering the coffees, and he's like, "What do you want?" And I said, and they're getting coffee and donuts. I was like, "You know what? I'll have a hot chocolate and a muffin." And he looks at me, and he's a 50-year-old a construction worker. I'm an 18-year-old who just ordered a hot cocoa and a muffin. And somehow, I forget some of the translation, but I came Twinkie for the rest of the summer to the work site. So he takes us back with our coffees, and he announces to the the 15 people on the work site, Twinkie got a hot cocoa, so make sure you don't drink Twinkie's hot cocoa. And he had me working. He assigned me to work. My boss, Jim, was kind of overseeing the work site, and he lent me to Frank, who was the oldest on the work site. He was easily into his 60s, a really big guy, always wore denim overalls, and he manned the sawhorses and wood cutting. He was in charge with making measurements, cutting wood, and then others on the work site were actually we were framing out a shed that was also meant to mirror the tin roofing we were doing on this. And he'd always say to me, he said, Twinkie, I've never forgotten a measurement in 40 years. 1976 in Hoboken, it was a door that was 56 inches and 3/4. I never forget a measurement. And he'd tell me this. I'm like, that's great. I would just go for it, like move wood and shingles between two sites. And throughout the summer, we had a few job sites like that, work like that. I was called Twinkie. I was tormented when I climbed up ladders with shackle buckets of tools. They would throw nails at me or tools from the roof, and I would give measurements from Jim to Frank, and Frank would cut them. And I noticed over the summer that they would fight sometimes. I was dealing with two very contrasting perspectives on this. Jim, in his 50s, probably still far more active than Frank in his 60s, and Jim would holler from the top of a roof, "You're off by an inch, you're off by an inch," and they would shout, and Frank would say, "I've never gotten a measurement wrong in 40 years, I haven't gotten one wrong now," and they would both say to me and assume that I had messed this up somehow, so they would say, "Write down the measurements," and I'd say, I wrote down, I don't know what, so, but always, I was the problem throughout this summer. I went through a few jobs. I made lots of mistakes, but there was always this undercurrent of Jim never feeling like the measurements got done right by Frank, and Frank saying that was the one thing that he had complete control over, that he would never get a measurement wrong, so there was no way that he got one wrong. Now, I remember getting into Jim's truck maybe later in the summer, and him saying, that SOB needs to retire. He doesn't know what he's doing. And I remember sensing for the first time that someone wasn't mad at me on a work site and was in fact confiding in me about being mad at someone. And it was actually a really uncomfortable feeling. And I recognized how parental, I suppose, my relationship had become as an 18-year-old with what was effectively a crumbling marriage between two work site owners who were not seeing eye to eye. And I didn't want that. I didn't want to be confided in. I very much wanted these two men to be able to work together. I remember a few weeks before the end of that summer, Jim said, report to Frank's house on Monday. Don't come to the work site. And I didn't quite know what to make of that, but I had a habit of asking too many questions and being told pretty oftenly that you're not paid to ask questions, you're paid to pick shit up off the ground, which was pretty normally what I was told. So I didn't ask any questions about that and just showed up to Frank's house. And we were cleaning up his shed and doing kind of, you know, basic home repair, We ended that maybe week of work cleaning out some stuff in his house, and he pays me and he gives me a $40 tip, which was everything to me. And he said, Chris, let me ask you. I never got a single measurement wrong this whole summer, did I? And I didn't really know, to be entirely honest, because I didn't know, frankly, all of what they were talking about. It was always an inch in here and 3/4. You know, it was with things that I didn't understand. It was, you know, I wasn't paying attention, to be totally honest. I think I was doodling in my notepad while I was getting measurements, and it was hardly what I was paying attention to. But I felt like the right answer to tell Frank was, no, Frank, you never got anything wrong. And he shook my hand, and I left. And I went to my first semester in undergrad, and I remember getting a call, maybe midway through the semester from Jim, from my direct boss. And Jim's like, Twinkie, what are you doing this winter? I don't know. It's like I got a big job, and I need someone on it. Come join me. I was like, sure, sure. He's like, and can you work nights? And I'd never been asked that question before, but I think he was offering $12.50 an hour instead of $8.50 an hour, so $12.50 sounded great to me. So of course, yeah, I can work overnight. And so that December, I pulled up to a suburban kind of pretty generic shopping mall parking lot in my 1992 Acura Integra that was turquoise and fuming out, I'm sure. And I had my radio stolen when I was an undergrad, so it just was wires hanging. And I had a boombox that had a broken antenna that I kept in my car so I could play radio while I drove. And so I came up and it was at 10 p.m. and I pulled up playing bad country music on a boombox inside of a 1992 Acura Integra in a winter hat and sweatpants. I can remember Jim holding me. He's at his truck and he's getting tools out. And I get out and he said, "You're late and you're still an idiot," was what he welcomed me with after not seeing me for 4 months. And I said, "Nice to see you too." And we got to work. And we were working on a pet store. And when you have a pet store that needs massive renovation and you don't want to disrupt your kindly customers, you do it overnight and you find a contractor who can find someone who can pay $12.50 an hour at the high end to get the job done. And that was us. And after a couple of days, I remember that we were doing the exact kind of work that normally Frank would be involved in. Jimmy was giving me the measurements and having me cut. And so I remember saying, "Hey, Jim, why isn't Frank on this job?" And Jim's like, "Frank and me don't work together no more. The guy can't count for shit." And so I remember saying, "Well, I mean, Jimmy, that was the one thing that Frank said he always had right. You know, he never got any measurement wrong." And I remember saying that I could count every bubble in that fish tank and get it wrong and tell you I had it right. And there'd be a very different thing about whether I remembered it or just flatly gave you a number. And that's what Frank always was. Frank was no good. So you're here to write down measurements and let me pay you half as much. And I remember feeling that I had been promoted in this field that I deserved no promotion in. because I was a very, very, very mediocre at best employee, but that it came down to a kind of pride that Frank had but no longer should have anymore and was frightened by it, that Frank couldn't bear to believe that he could get measurements wrong, so he never allowed for the fact that maybe he was all along. And that was when I grasped this idea that you can all the time say, "I remember something." It doesn't mean that it's true, and how different that is than forgetting something. So it was something I learned, and I made sure to write my measurements down that entire winter. And that was the last project I ever worked with Jim on. But it taught me a lot about counting bubbles in fish tanks. And that's my story.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So can we still call you Twinkie?
Yeah, you can. Still call me Twinkie. Twinkie still remains the single worst nickname I've ever had.
Fabulous.
But it remains what I am.
So as an employer,
yeah,
what attributes did you take away from that you actually employ at your...
Yeah, so I run a small company, and I probably do look back sometimes at how I was treated by my various employers in the construction fields. I look back with great admiration and love with how those men, and they all were men, treated me through those years. I always, despite the stories that I tell, I always got a great warmth from them. And so I like to believe that I torture my teammates in exactly the same loving way that they did, because I actually really quite loved how they treated me. I think it was always There was always a sense of pride that they had a craft, and so some idiot 18-year-old, of course, was didn't belong to be in the same room as them. And I actually really liked that. That, you know, if they were going to hang drywall, they were going to do it so well that course this 18-year-old is going to get everything wrong. So I think a pride in work was something that I was always really fond of. That of course there's a right way to swing a roofing hammer, and you are an idiot because you were doing it wrong. And I would try all the time and say, well, no, my way is a better way. And he would tell me how wrong I was. So yeah, there was a lot of lessons from that. I think that now that I've referenced the roofing hammer, there's nothing more that could possibly be said on the subject matter. It's all that there is to be said on Bubbles. So I want to close out. First, can we do a round of applause for our wonderful storyteller, Arjuna, Yuri, and Elle, and myself? We'll just do that. Two, if you're interested in future story shuffles, do them every other month or so. You should reach out to me. I'm at Christopher Wink on Twitter. You should definitely come out and join one. Storyshuffle.com has all of our past hearings. And by that, I mean shows. That's another word for that. I want to thank Nathan and Tegan and the whole team at behind the 4th Annual Philadelphia Podcast Festival. They're fantastic. Really appreciate that. So make sure to check out all the recordings. And those recordings really happen in great part thanks to SteelEmpire.com. That's Steel with three E's. Yeah, we love them. A great recording, audio recording company. And Amalgam Comics, our host for the day. Amalgam Comics, 2578 Frankfurt Ave. They're a fantastic comic and coffee shop in Philadelphia. Thank you for coming to this next recording of the Philadelphia Podcast Festival and Story Shuffle. I hope you'll be out to future ones. Thanks so much, everyone. Bye.